From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a major study tracks lead-poisoned kids in New Zealand as they grew to adulthood with major warnings for Flint and its children.
It's an unfortunate but helpful study of what you can expect when there's no extra intervention.
Plus, a newly discovered shipwreck in Lake Superior offers a stunning window to the past.
This is one of the best preserved shipwrecks that I've ever seen.
How America's UFO craze of 1966 began with a Dexter farmer.
When this thing stopped and then came down and hovered above a tree there in the back of his house, swampy area, that really caught his attention.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Flint residents have settled a huge lawsuit with the city and state over the water crisis. The state is agreeing to pay the $87 million needed for brand new water lines. Originally, the residents who filed that lawsuit wanted bottled water delivered to every home in Flint without a working water filter. Instead, the state promises it'll go door to door and make sure everyone's got a filter and knows how to use it. And the state will keep delivering bottled water to homebound residents and anybody who calls 211, but only for the next few months. Switching Flint to water from the Flint River poisoned its children. Now, that's not opinion. That's scientific fact. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha first sounded the alarm in the summer of 2015. Her tests proved after Flint made that water change, blood lead levels in Flint kids skyrocketed. And that was later confirmed by a CDC analysis. It found children who drank Flint water had a 50% higher risk of dangerously elevated blood lead levels than before the switch. That analysis from the CDC couldn't say exactly how many kids were affected, nor what their futures hold. But a study published today in the Journal of the American Medical Association might hold some answers, because researchers from Duke University studied childhood lead exposure and adult outcomes. Aaron Rubin is with us. He's a doctoral student in clinical neuropsychology at Duke, and he's principal investigator and author in this newly published JAMA investigation. With us now from Duke University. Aaron, what was the question you were looking to answer with this study?
Well, thank you for having me here. Our main goal with this study was to figure out what we can anticipate the long-term consequences of childhood lead exposure will be. We were able to do one of the longest follow-ups on a group of lead-exposed children, which was about to midlife.
This group comes from New Zealand, right?
That's right. This is a sort of very special cohort study. It's a longitudinal birth cohort, and that means we've been following them since they were born. And it's everyone who was born in one town in the South Island of New Zealand in the early 70s.
How were they exposed to lead?
Yeah, this part surprised us. New Zealand for many years had some of the highest lead in gasoline levels of any country in the world. And that meant that lead exposures in this town, it was a small town, about 150,000 people, lead exposures were higher than you would have expected, and they were comparable to what we saw in the U.S. and other developed countries in that era. And those exposures came from lead emissions out of car tailpipes mostly.
From having read your study, I'm realizing that that meant that the children with these elevated lead levels were found in all socioeconomic levels, correct?
That's correct. And that was the unique thing about this group. In most places, we know lead burden tends to be borne a lot more by lower income communities. Partly when lead was in gasoline, that was people who lived near busy roads, highways, but also people who lived near lead emitting industrial sites. And then also people in older homes with lead paint and lead pipes. In New Zealand, sort of by a quirk of the way the city was built, there aren't that many big roads. Neighborhoods are sort of equally dense. And we saw variations in lead exposure, but those variations didn't depend on someone's socioeconomic status. So high-status children and low-status children sort of had equal lead exposures.
As this cohort has been tracked since the early 70s, what are the findings? What lies ahead in adulthood?
We looked at two things for this study. One was cognitive abilities measured by an IQ test, and the other was socioeconomic status, which we measured by asking them what their occupations were. And we found that 30 years after lead exposure, those children who had received a higher lead dose had, on average, lower IQs than their less exposed peers, and accompanying that lower IQ was a lower socioeconomic status.
So those IQ, those lower midlife IQ scores, they reflected an actual decline in IQ?
That's right. So we compared them at midlife to their peers, and they were lower, but we also were able to compare them to themselves before they had experienced the lead exposure, because we've been following them since birth. So we'd measured their IQ in childhood. We measured lead a little later, you know, lead exposure. And now, 30 years later, we've measured IQ again, and we found that those exposed to lead actually saw a decline in their intellectual abilities.
And then what did you find in terms of social mobility and occupations?
Well, that was the interesting thing, is we started with this sort of cognitive finding. We saw sort of decline in IQ, but it was mild. It certainly wasn't anything that would send you rushing to the doctor. But we wondered, does this mild drop in IQ imply sort of larger implications for someone's life? And that is what led us to look at economic standing. And we found that relative to their parents, children who had been exposed to higher levels of lead actually went down the socioeconomic ladder. They attained occupations that required a little less education, that probably returned lower incomes. And this was true regardless of where the children started out in life. So higher status or lower status children, everyone who had experienced more lead exposure tended to go down the economic ladder relative to where they came from.
To clarify, then, that downward social mobility couldn't be attributed to low socioeconomic status of the families or the IQ scores of parents. So this was separate from that.
Exactly.
Why are these findings, Aaron, so important?
Well, to us, this should be a sort of warning sign of what you can expect long term if you don't intervene. So our group of children had pretty high exposures at the time. They were considered harmless, sort of routine. And with the exception of a handful of kids in our study who had very high exposures and were referred for follow-up and additional testing and assessment, most kids in our study didn't receive any special attention. So in the 70s and 80s, they had these exposures that we now know aren't safe, but nothing was given in terms of additional support. And so what we find in terms of negative outcomes is what you can expect if you do nothing. The exposures we're seeing today in Flint and other places in the U.S., they're not quite the same. You know, we know our cohort members likely had ongoing sort of chronic lead exposure, and we know that now we've figured out kids in Lint have been exposed to lead, and we're doing everything we can to prevent additional exposures. That's probably going to help. Our study implies that you're going to want to do extra things too. You're going to want to continue to follow up. You're going to want to provide extra interventions to forestall some of these long-term negative consequences that we now know might accrue to people who've been exposed as kids.
Well, indeed, Aaron, we've heard story after story from families in Flint who have a lot of great fears for how that lead will affect their children. And so that's what I'm kind of wondering. How inevitable are the kinds of adult outcomes that you're describing in this New Zealand cohort? I mean, were there some individuals who were exposed to lead as children who went on to do better, have better IQ scores and better cognitive function and better social mobility than the others?
The average trend in our cohort was for people to move up the social ladder. And actually, we also saw that they tended, on average, to have higher IQs. So it was really only the kids who had the highest exposures who went down in both IQ and economic status. That said, the way we tested the effects of lead allowed us to find a sort of linear relationship between lead exposure and the outcomes. So any incremental additional exposure was bad. It doesn't matter if you had a little or a lot. But the kids who had sort of lower exposures did turn out all right. And our findings don't tell us what happens when you intervene. It's possible that the kind of interventions people are talking about rolling out in Flint now, you know, regular monitoring to avoid new exposures, expanded access to early education, better access to behavioral health services, better nutrition. We know from other studies that things like that should move the needle. We don't know if that will forestall, you know, these long-term consequences, but there's plenty of reasons to think that would be true.
And certainly it seems from your study that public policy responses are critical, that there will be a real need for long-term support and for funding as these children grow into adulthood and they're bearing a burden which was imposed on them in the name of cutting costs.
Absolutely. And that was what we were hoping to learn when we started our follow-up. Will there be long-term consequences, and can what we find be used to inform policy decisions? And I think the answer is yes.
What questions does your study raise then about what the right public response should be?
It's not clear exactly, you know, when you should best intervene or at what level are you going to see irreversible damage. The fact that we were able to detect IQ and economic deficits almost 30 years later to us implies that at the very least you're going to want a long-term response that follows people. You know, maybe you don't need to be intervening for many, many years, but at the very least you need to be checking in because absent intervention, people don't recover.
The message to elected officials, both at the state and federal levels, tell me if I'm wrong, I'm hearing, don't put it on the back burner.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, one thing that we're very careful to point out is this is one study. It's in one group of people. It's in one city. We do think the people we've studied are representative of people in the U.S. But we also found that, as we discussed earlier, lead exposures in our group weren't accumulated in particular communities that were low resource. They were shared across the socioeconomic strata, which we know isn't true in the U.S. And there's reason to believe that lead is going to curtail upward social mobility. And when your lead exposures are sort of correlated with exposure to other adversities, it's possible that you might find even worse outcomes.
Aaron Rubin is with Duke University, and he's the author of the article, Childhood Blood Lead Level Predicts Mild Cognitive Decline and Downward Socioeconomic Mobility by Midlife. That article published today in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Aaron, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stateside is teaming up with Am I Curious, Michigan Radio's project that asks for your questions about our state and its people. There's so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours, we can't possibly know about it all. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. On April 22nd, we're going to do a stateside in Flint at the Flint Institute of Arts. What questions do you have about Flint, about its neighborhoods or its people? And we're particularly interested in hearing from people who live in Flint now. What questions do you have about your city? Send us your questions by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A window has opened that takes us back over 132 years. This time travel window is the wreck of the J.S. Seaburns. This freighter sank in May 1884 in Lake Superior, and there she lay undiscovered until last summer. Dan Fountain did all the detective work that helped a team of divers find this shipwreck, and boy, the Seaburns turned out to be astonishingly well-preserved. Dan, what was the Seaburn's job, and what was she carrying, and where was she going?
The Seaburns was carrying supplies and provisions for the contractors that were building the Canadian Pacific Railroad. It was also carrying some heavy freight for a couple of businesses on the north shore of Lake Superior.
So what can you tell us, what do we know about what happened that day in May of 1884? Why did she go down?
The Seaburns was on her maiden voyage from Chicago to the North Shore. Her first port of call was Michipicoten Harbor. The Seaburns pulled into Michipicoten Harbor, unloaded part of her freight, and as she was backing out near midnight on the night of the 12th, she ran into some rocks, put a hole in her bottom. The captain tried to beach the vessel some distance from the port, but was unable to make it to shore, and the vessel sank.
But we can talk about this shipwreck and not feel bad because everybody made it off, right?
Correct. Even though this was a cold night in the middle or in the early part of May on Lake Superior, there were no lives lost. It was a calm night, and all 15 crew and 45 passengers were able to get into the lifeboats and get safely to shore.
Dan, in the intervening years, had anyone tried to find her and salvage her, or did she just kind of slip off everybody's radar screen, so to speak?
Within the first year after the sinking, one of the people who owned material on the vessel tried to have it salvaged. He sent a salvage crew out to locate the vessel. They thought they located it, but it was in deep water and no salvage was ever done. After that, the wreck was basically forgotten for 130 some years.
And then what piqued your interest? What got you saying, you know what, I want to try to figure out where the Seaburns went down?
The first clue I had to the wreck was a 1906 chart of Lake Superior. looking over the chart and just looking at a few of the features on the wreck and a few of the wreck symbols that were marked on this chart, I noticed up in the far northeast corner of Lake Superior a shipwreck symbol and notation, the wreck of the Saffron. Well, that my interest piqued and looked in the usual sources trying to find information about the Saffron, never found anything. Turns out a few years later I learned about the wreck of the J.S. Severns and put two and two together, realized this was the same wreck, and here was an X on the chart showing us right where it should be.
So you did all the detective work, but you didn't actually dive, correct?
That's correct. I haven't been diving in a few years, and this is deep enough that you don't want to go in diving in that kind of depth when you're out of practice, let's say.
So what was the feeling like when the dive team hit the bullseye? There was a J.S. Severns who'd been undisturbed all these years.
I think we were all amazed at the condition of the wreck. Even though the upper cabins, which were lightly constructed, had collapsed, the lower cabins, which were part of the original build of the vessel, were very sturdily built and still intact. We were able to look into some of the crew accommodations. We were able to look into the galley and see dishes still on the shelves. This is one of the best preserved shipwrecks that I've ever seen.
Dan, could such a well-preserved shipwreck be found in other Great Lakes, do you think?
The beauty of finding shipwrecks in Lake Superior is the lack of marine growth. Over the last 20 years or so, zebra mussels and quagga mussels, which are invasive species from Europe, have taken over the lower lakes. And what these mussels like to do is grow and anchor themselves to any solid substrate, including shipwrecks. So the shipwrecks in Lake Superior are clean versus the ones in Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, all of which are totally encrusted and in many cases obscured by these mussels.
To have a ship that sank that was not destroyed, fairly intact, it's just good luck that it happened in Superior, that here you can all these years later look at it and say, look, we can see the plates.
Yeah, it's definitely a time capsule. This is a snapshot of this moment in time. You can see things that were obviously, these were not just a few dishes. This is a crate of dishes being hauled up there for the Canadian Pacific Railroad. There are broken open boxes of what we took a while to identify what this stuff was. It's actually boxes of salt pork that have burst open, and that salt pork still survives after all these years. So this is the provisions for the people building the railroad.
Wow, the salt pork survived. That says a lot about preservation, doesn't it?
It does. That and the preservative qualities of Lake Superior's cold water.
Dan, what is it that grabs you most about these Great Lakes shipwrecks?
I think what I appreciate most about them is, as in the case of the J.S. Severns, this is a time capsule. It's a snapshot into a moment in history when things have not been disturbed. Things are exactly as they were on May 12th of 1884.
Dan Fountain did all the detective work that helped a team of divers find the J.S. Severns that sank May 12, 1884 in Lake Superior, where she laid undiscovered until this team was able to find her. Dan, thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
My pleasure.
Among the big life questions we face, this is one of the biggest, whether or not to have a baby. Detroit-based writer and radio producer Zach Rosen is good at telling stories. You've often heard them right here on Stateside. Well, now he's telling a very personal story, how he and his wife, Shira, are figuring out the answer to that big baby question. It's a new podcast they call Pregnant Pause.
How did you get to this point of just knowing that you wanted to do it?
I think that I realized that the things that were making me hesitant about having kids, which were one, like the world is so evil and so sad and everything, police brutality, racism, homophobia, terrorism, just hate. But I think with all of that, I just am like, not having kids doesn't solve that, doesn't let me cope with it better. Like, yeah, I'm bringing them into it, but I'm also bringing them into a world that could be so joyful, so enriching, so nurturing, could be so awesome also.
Zach Rosen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, collecting and telling other people's stories, you do that beautifully, but telling your deeply personal story, that is something else altogether. What inspired you to open up your lives this way?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons we chose to do this. One, I love podcasts. I love radio, and always thought, like, if I had a show, what would it be about? And for years and years, I didn't have a good answer to put myself in the center of it until my wife and I started having this conversation of whether or not we should have kids. And it brought up a bunch of kind of anxiety and just some questions that I didn't anticipate coming up. I always assumed that we would just have kids, but once we actually started talking about it, I realized that it was this kind of tender point in my own inner world, and I didn't know why I was feeling that. So I thought, okay, here's something where it can be an exploration. I can try to find some answers, and that seems like something that a listener could glom onto, especially maybe listeners our age who might be dealing with this question themselves.
It's kind of funny in a way, Zach. I grew up in the 60s and I got married in the mid 70s. And the things that you and Shira wonder about in that clip we just played with all the trouble in the world and do you bring a baby into it, our generation had the same conversations. We had the prospect of nuclear annihilation, the Vietnam War. We were reading Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, my parents told me the same thing. And, you know, if you look at the data, we are living in the most peaceful time in human history, but it doesn't seem like that because of Facebook and because of headline news, and we're just kind of bombarded with every bad thing that happens. You know, a couple generations ago, we just wouldn't have known about something terrible happening in Turkey. So it's this kind of strange paradox of, yeah, it's a safe time, but it really doesn't feel that way.
How much did digging in and recording and creating these podcasts really help you and Shira in your decision? Was it therapeutic?
It was. I mean, I've always thought that, you know, our microphones give us license to ask people questions that we wouldn't otherwise ask them without a microphone. And so, yeah, I was just kind of able to ask for people's advice, ask about their lived experiences, to be able to talk to a climate scientist and a philosopher and a writer, many writers, about this. Yeah, just getting it out there helps tremendously. It went from, you know, me having all this kind of unresolved, tangled up anxiety that I didn't really know what to do with, to just kind of putting it out there and just kind of acknowledging that it was there, which I think that certainly helps, podcast or not.
So you've dropped the first two episodes. What do you hope your listeners will get out of it?
I mean, the thing that I always love in movies and books and music is like stuff that's funny and sad. But more so, I just hope that people are resonating with these questions we're asking. And we've already gotten a couple emails from listeners saying, oh my God, I've thought this same thing. Thank you so much for putting a voice to it. And that was super gratifying, just to hear that this is a pretty common journey that a lot of us are going on.
The podcast is Pregnant Pause. Zach Rosen taking us along the journey as he and his wife Shira decide whether or not they're going to have a baby. You can find it by going to pregnantpausepodcast.com. Zach, thanks so much. We'll look forward to listening to your podcast.
Thanks for having me on. This has been fun.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers are releasing their newest album. It's titled Pluto. The six-member band is rooted in Lansing, Kalamazoo, and Grand Rapids, known for their eccentric style, mixing elements of funk, dance pop, and R&B. Frontman Joe Hertler stopped by our studios to give us a preview of the new music.
Check, check, check. Yo, yo, yo. Hello. My name is Joe Hertler.
Sit around and watch the days go by. Between computer screens, you're living things. Am I the only one to see the sign upon the bathroom stall? I said it burning, baby. I burned it down.
Our first single, it's called Lonely. I actually wrote it on a reed accordion, which it just looks like a big box with a bunch of accordion keys on it. It's like easy songwriting. You can just like push the key and like notes come out. It's really cool. But anyways, at the time of writing this song, I was working what was supposed to be a dream job right out of college. I'd been there for about a year, and it just, like, was going really poorly. I was pretty unhappy. At the time of writing it, it was right around the time where I was leaving this place. So part of the song is kind of me saying, like, I'm not ready to sign my life away to the cubicle world. But ultimately what the song's about, it's kind of for anyone who's, like, just working a job that they're not crazy about. But they're there because they're working for something much greater than themselves. Like everyone else. Our next single is called Old Love. It's based off of a Japanese fable called the Chrysanthemum Pledge. I actually wrote the song on bass. Women on the battlefield drink from the ladle by the moon. The blood expand across the fields like chrysanthemums in blue. The story centers around two samurai. They're on different teams and they meet on the battlefield during a great war, and they fall in love. But unfortunately, they can't be together because they're on warring factions. Well, you finished what you started. I was born to believe that the change in the leaves could really mean anything, love. I crossed the mountains and the ocean for ya. Just to see, I need the old love. So they make a promise to each other that once the war is over, that they're going to get back together once the chrysanthemums bloom. Unfortunately, the war finishes and the chrysanthemums bloom, and they're unable to get back together. So they commit harakiri, which is the ritual act of disembowelment. They commit suicide. And there's a section of the song during the bridge where one of the samurai is committing suicide, and he's kind of like slumping over this like moonlit pool, and there's rose blooms kind of flowing out of his abdomen. His soul departs from his body and he floats up to heaven, and there's his lover who's also committed the same thing. And when writing it, it started kind of as this like silly, you know, the song's really upbeat and it started sort of silly, but as I was writing it, I felt more and more connected to these characters, and I think their story just felt very honest and sincere, and really, really wanted to do justice, not to just the story, but the characters and their struggle. And yeah, I'm just happy how it turned out, and we have a music video as well that will be coming out that's very literal in the story, and I can't wait for it to be released. Hopefully that will come out in the end of April. Yeah, I'd like to talk about one more song. It's called Disconnected, and the message of the song is pretty simple. I think for a lot of people, you get caught up in your passions, your drives, like maybe it's your job. I know for me with music, I can be pretty like tunnel vision with all of it, and sometimes you just don't always smell the roses. You don't always like recognize there are people all around you who are like trying to give you love, and sometimes you just have to accept that love, but more importantly, you have to give it back. Dead trees rising up like boneyards. Rest at the end of the days. A crescent moon over a desert whisper. The slanting sun folding back on her rays. At the end of the day, at the end of the day. And I think in a way too that like the overall concept of this record is human connectivity and how you just don't want to let it fall to the wayside. I know for me I'm not like the best talker, but it's through songs that I'm able to connect with people. Hey, Stateside listeners, we have a couple shows coming up this month. They're city release shows. We have the 30th and 31st at the Blind Pig. It will likely be the last time we ever play there because the Blind Pig is being sold. And then also, we have the brand new venue in Grand Rapids. We've played it once before and it is beautiful, but it's 21 Monroe Live, and that is going to be April 1st. Again, these are city release shows. We're going all out for them, and we are so, so excited.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Many Detroit neighborhoods need help. A lot of blocks are little more than a couple of occupied homes, abandoned houses, burned-out structures, and overgrown vacant lots. But the worst neighborhoods are not the city's priority. Instead, the mayor is helping better neighborhoods. Reporting for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham looks at this approach.
As you undoubtedly know, Detroit's downtown business districts are booming. Corporate offices are moving in, retailers are opening new stores, empty buildings are being rehabbed into upscale apartments. Detroit's neighborhoods, though, are not doing as well. Here's Mayor Mike Duggan during his recent State of the City address.
I get asked, it seems like every day, you've got all this investment in downtown and midtown. It's great, I like it, but when's the investment coming to the neighborhoods?
The mayor went on to say neighborhood investment starts now. He announced a neighborhood development program amounting to $30 million in public-private investments.
We're starting in three neighborhoods to prove it makes a difference. In the Livernois-McNichols area, in the West Village area on the east side, and in southwest Detroit near Clark Park.
These three neighborhoods already do better than most of the city. Livernois-McNichols includes Marygrove College and abuts University of Detroit Mercy. The West Village area is full of apartment buildings, nice duplexes, a few trendy restaurants with some more retail stores planned. And the area near Clark Park is better known as Mexican Town. It's been vibrant for a long time. This approach is like reverse battlefield triage. Instead of helping the worst damaged areas of the city first, Mayor Duggan is helping those neighborhoods with greater potential. As a strategy, it might make sense. If you live in one of the struggling neighborhoods such as Morningside, it's frustrating.
If we can't, if we can't save Morningside, then what hope is there for Detroit's comeback?
Eric DeWicke lives in Morningside, has for 24 years. He also happens to be a lecturer in urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. We spent a couple of hours driving around the Morningside neighborhood.
This is a brand new tenant in this particular building.
DeWicke had a brief conversation with Mayor Duggan about the street where DeWicke lives, 3 Mile Drive.
And he said, this was last spring, we've got some work to do on 3 Mile. And I said, yes, we do, Mr. Mayor. So I think if the mayor understands 3 Mile and he understands we have these issues and we still aren't getting changes to the system, what must other neighborhoods who don't have that advantage have to go through?
The advantage? Duggan's grandparents lived on 3 Mile, and as a child he spent a lot of weekends there. Today, Morningside is certainly not the worst neighborhood in Detroit, but it's not the best. It's more or less a microcosm of the city. There are many vacant homes. The city promised demolitions of some of the gutted homes last year. They're still standing. But then DeWicke drove me past block after block of 1920s-era brick Tudors and other really nice houses. DeWicke says Morningside's business district along Warren Avenue is a little better. In the last couple of years, a few of its vacant buildings filled with small retailers, but about half of the buildings are still boarded up. DeWicke says it's not as though Duggan has done nothing for Morningside. Streetlights, more regular garbage pickup, a new small park.
But what I feel is the kind of modus operandi of the administration, for the most part, is, well, we hire all these smart people and these experts, and we understand what the issue is and what needs to be done. And so, yeah, we don't really need your help, people out there in the neighborhoods.
That's a sentiment people in more than one neighborhood express. As Mayor Duggan turns his attention to investment in the neighborhoods, he says he wants the residents to have more say in what happens. He says in the Livernois-McNichols neighborhood, 40 meetings were held to see what neighbors wanted. And the mayor says if the investments in those three neighborhoods work, there will be $30 million more to invest in other neighborhoods. People in Morningside hope the mayor remembers his grandparents' neighborhood when and if those investments come in the future. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This was the week in 1966 when Michigan was swept by UFO fever. It all started with a sighting over a farm in Dexter. And it wasn't long before the venerable Walter Cronkite himself was anchoring a CBS report, UFO, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy.
Good evening. Reports of flying saucers are nothing new. From the beginning of recorded time, men have been seeing unexplainable things in the sky. And there's no reason to doubt they saw something. The question is, was what they saw really there? And what was it they really saw? The great flying saucer mystery of 1966 began here, near Dexter, Michigan, late in March.
And that uncorked it. Soon UFO reports were pouring in from one end of the country to the other. Harry Wilness was teaching in Southeast Michigan in the 1960s, and Harry's been investigating UFO sightings for some 60 years. With us now, welcome, Harry.
Thank you.
I was in junior high school at the time, at the risk of dating myself, but I so well remember that everybody had UFO fever 51 years ago right now. And it wasn't just here in Michigan, was it?
No, actually, this was a widespread phenomenon over a number of states, and it went on for quite some time. This was not just one event that happened in Dexter, but days and weeks before that, and it continued for days and weeks and actually months after that period.
Well, let's listen to a clip from that CBS report. Here is father of 10, Frank Manor, a farmer from Dexter, and he's describing just what happened when his six dogs began barking the night of March 20th, 1966, and he went out to see what was going on over his swamp.
I looked to the north of me, and there were looked like a fallen star. It was red and kind of coming down, and when it got to the top of the trees, it stopped, and a blue and a white light come on it. And I looked at it, and I thought I was seeing things.
And Harry, this sounds like a very practical man, not one given to flights of fancy, but this flying saucer wasn't a quick here-and-gone thing, was it?
No, it wasn't. When he saw this object, he thought at first, of course, it was a falling star, but when this thing stopped and then came down and hovered above a tree there in the back of his house, swampy area, that really caught his attention.
And it was, what, like over 4 hours? And he wasn't the only one to see it, right?
No, this was quite an event. Actually, that night there were a group of townies which gathered. This did take place over some 4 hours, this object or objects would come and go. And what really caught his attention was that this thing drifted on down and appeared to land in the swamp. And then that's when he got his son, Ron, and decided they were going to go in and have a look. I believe that the mother was told to call the Washtenaw County Sheriff. And eventually that night, there were six squad cars with 12 or 13 deputies and actually three detectives who showed up over this 4 or 5 hour time period to take an observation of what this thing was.
And they saw it.
They saw it at various times. Again, this thing would come and go. When Frank did wander into the swamp, if you read the police report, which I got a copy of, which was written by deputies Fitzpatrick and McFadden, they were at one end of the swamp. And when this thing took off, it's actually in the police report, they said it sounded like a rifle shot in a canyon. There was also reports of this thing sounding like an ambulance siren.
But sadly, there were no such things as cameras on smartphones so people could snap pictures, right? Because nobody got a picture of what happened that night?
Deputy McFadden, I believe, did take some pictures. But taking pictures at night, even nowadays, what you basically just get are blurbs of light.
And so the Air Force got involved with this too, didn't it?
They sure did. For some reason, this was picked up by the newspapers. There were many other reports and sightings which were probably far better than this. But this raised so much of a ruckus that the Air Force, Project Blue Book, they did investigate UFOs until 1969, and they sent their top front man, that's Dr. Alan Hynek, who I got to know very well over time after this, they sent him to Dexter and to Hillsdale. There was another report the following night, of course, in Hillsdale. They sent him here to track down exactly what was happening and said, why don't you also hold a press conference? Let's explain what this was.
And so what was the explanation?
Well, this is very interesting. Hynek was taken by Washtenaw County Sheriff, that's Doug Harvey, who I also interviewed. He was taken out to the Manor Farm. He put some boots on, sloshed around in the swamp. On the way back to the office, Hynek admitted to the sheriff. He said, you know, I don't know what people saw. And something very interesting happened after that. Very few people know this. After they were in the office, Hynek got a call from Washington, and I asked Doug Harvey, how do you know what was from Washington? He said, because the dispatcher stepped into the room and said, Dr. Hynek, you've got a call from Washington. Hynek stepped out of the office, took the call, came back in a few minutes later. Harvey described him as looking a bit shooken. He had his head down, and he was mumbling, swamp gas, swamp gas. It was swamp gas. I don't think Hynek knew at that time what swamp gas was. And for your listeners, a lot of people have certainly heard that term.
We have heard the term. What does it mean?
It's a phenomenon that can occur in swampy areas. It can be gaseous substances like methane, which at certain times of the year, under certain conditions, can kind of bubble up. Occasionally, it can ignite and form a bubble and kind of drift off and actually be a lighted structure-like. And this thing can float there for a bit and then maybe just pop out. It can sometimes give crackling or popping noises. And then across a swamp, maybe, there's another one that occurs that might give the appearance of movement.
I'm trying to read between the lines. So when the doctor went in, he was different when he came out after taking that phone call. Do you think somebody in Washington said, zip it and say it's swamp gas, but there really was something more to it?
I think he was looking for an explanation, and there are a lot of stories out there about how Hynek came up with swamp gas. One was he got this from a U of M chemistry professor. Another story I heard were a group of astronomers met with Hynek the night before the press conference, and they were searching for some kind of an explanation, and maybe that's where it came up. But I think the real story is the one that Doug Harvey, Washtenaw County Sheriff, told me about how Hynek took that phone call from Washington.
His changed demeanor.
His changed demeanor, correct.
And I know even Michigan Congressman, then Michigan Congressman Gerald Ford, kind of weighed in on all of this. So Congress was involved as well?
Well, after the press conference held at the Detroit Press Club, again, this was picked up by the newspapers. Hynek, again, at this press conference, he was a man on the spot. He needed some kind of an explanation. He said he was literally invaded by hordes of reporters, people crowding around, shouting questions. They were looking for little green men, he said. And, of course, they didn't get that. He needed something, and he lashed onto the swamp gas. But he did say over and over, I cannot prove this in a court of law. This may not be the explanation, but it's a possibility. He needed something because the press was in such an uproar. This was in virtually every newspaper in the country.
How long did this last, and when did it kind of die down?
I can't say for certain, but I know that this went on for some weeks after. The 1960s were a great time for UFO reports. So this went on for a period of time.
1966, NASA was winding up the Gemini program, and it was ramping up the Apollo program and working its way to that moonshot that we saw 3 years later. Could some of this be chalked up to space fever?
At that time, no, I really don't think so. Some of these reports, there were far better reports than what took place at the Frank Manor Farm. One report, a Washtenaw County sheriff, had a UFO hovering 75 feet over his car. He said it knocked out his radio. He had radio problems. So no, this wasn't space junk or the space program.
What do you think?
Oh, I think I've been studying this again for some 60 years. I'm convinced that planet Earth is being observed. The present figures are that about every 3 minutes somewhere in the world, a UFO is seen. Most go unreported, but they are seen very frequently. And I tell people, if you don't believe in this stuff, fine. But ask your 10 best friends this question. Hey, have you ever seen a UFO? Have you had some kind of an experience that you couldn't quite figure out what it was? And you'll find that one of your friends, on average, is going to say, you know, I have seen something. And then you got to be a good listener. Don't make a smart remark like, what were you drinking or what were you smoking that night? What you've got to do is be serious about it and ask them to share the story with you.
Why do you think, as you say, if there's one every 3 minutes, why aren't we talking about it now? You saw how, for example, the clown sightings swept everywhere, the crazy clown sightings last year. Why are we not buzzing about it in 2017 the way that America was in 1966?
You know, we've really been conditioned to this. You can thank our U.S. government for this because there's been a long history of debunking. In other words, the government did not want to deal with this. They did not want reports like this coming in consistently.
And why not?
Well, people have studied this, and part of the problem would be that if it did come out that Earth was being watched, that we were, in effect, being looked at by other intelligences, there would be some serious ramifications. One thing would be the energy factor, and maybe they've got some kind of energy that would really help us. You can imagine that maybe big coal or oil or other energy producers might not want this to come out because it might really infringe on their business. Another thing, there might be panic. Some people just could not accept this. I'm wondering what certain religions would do to actually have to admit that, yes, there are intelligences. They may have a problem.
Now, in all of your decades studying this, have you ever laid eyes on a UFO?
I've actually had one sighting, and it was a daylight affair, but it was very, very high. It moved very quickly across the sky. It was on a Tuesday night about 7 o'clock. We used to play basketball at my house. My back was bothering me. I went over on the grass and laid out just to stretch my back out. I never would have seen this otherwise. Clear blue sky. I looked straight up, and this object was, my sense was it was much higher than a plane, but it was moving 6 to 8 times as fast as a jet would move across the sky. That's my only sighting, but I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of other people who have had far better sightings than that.
Well, years worth of work, and when we all think about what was going on that started in Dexter, Michigan in 1966, it is fascinating. Harry Wilness, UFO investigator and retired teacher. Thank you so much for being with us, Harry.
Thank you.
Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, let's fly away. They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say, if a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are, we'd better fly away.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.